Welcome to the Resource People Podcast, presented to you by Australian Resources and Energy Group, AMA. The Resource People Podcast brings to life the stories behind the people, workforces and companies of our great industry.
Welcome to Resource People Podcast. I'm Tara Diamond from AMA. It's absolutely wonderful to have you join us for this episode where I have the pleasure of having a fantastic chat with Professor Robert Wood. Now, Bob, as he's well known, is a distinguished professor and director of the Futures Academy at the University of Technology, Sydney. Bob has co-founded and directed the company Cognicity, which many of you will know for its work on unconscious bias, the Centre of Ethical Leadership at Ormond College at the University of Melbourne, and the Accelerated Learning Laboratory at AGSM. He was a member of the Prime Minister's Science, Engineering and Innovation Council's Working Group into Transforming Learning in Australian Society. Now, the academic roll call of Bob's career goes on and on, but in addition to that, he has designed, developed and delivered programs for senior managers and many Australians and overseas organisations, including Westpac, Santos, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Newmont, P&O Ports, the Australian Defence Force, the list goes on and on. He is also a fellow of the Australian New Zealand Academy of Management, the American Psychology Association, and a fellow and executive board member of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia and the International Association of Applied Psychology. Are you exhausted hearing that list? Well, it's absolutely fascinating. And Bob, in this short podcast, really takes us through a number of really important areas for resource and energy employers, particularly diversity and inclusion, the impact of COVID, what's happening with workforces, and Bob's really passionate work around adaptivity. I really hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to Resource People Podcast, Bob.
Thanks, Tara. It's great to be here.
We can't start without asking about your background and your fascinating career. Bob, can you give us an overview?
Well, actually, my background starts with the mining industry because I grew up in Kalgoorlie. And so I grew up during one of them, sort of the major mining booms, you know, with nickel and gold being discovered around Kalgoorlie. So a lot of people I went to high school with ended up working in the mining industry, you know, as explorers or drillers or any number of things. I actually was planning to do geology, but then for a variety of reasons, I actually moved to Perth to play football for a team called South Fremantle, not to go to university. But then I ended up working at BHP's Kwinana plant. There was a steel mill there, a blast furnace and like. So I worked there and I was given a cadetship. And so then I worked for BHP for several years and then got interested in going overseas, met somebody who had been studying. So I applied and was given a scholarship and then went off and ended up becoming an academic, which I think was a surprise to everybody I'd been to school with and the teachers. So I still go back to Kalgoorlie for reunions of the football team and high school, and they always express great surprise that I would end up a professor. So,
oh, wow. Yeah. Well, I'm going to get on to your kind of academic and commercial career in a little moment, but I want to ask about what you're currently doing because you're the director of the Futures Academy at the University of Technology in Sydney. Can you tell us about the Academy? It's fairly recent. And tell us about your role and what your focus is for the Academy.
Well, I was brought in to help set up the Futures Academy. I've set up and run several centres and a couple of companies and the like. The basic idea was to help people understand where their position vis-a-vis emerging jobs in the sort of the future of work. You know, there's, you know, increasing digital. Well, it's not just the sort of digital transformation of society, which was really sped up by COVID, but big shifts in focus. So a lot of for example, in the health area and a variety of areas, a lot of growth in areas like data analytics. And associated with that is a lot of reskilling. So a lot of jobs that, you know, which we think of as quite complex jobs like accounting or law, a lot of those are being programmed up into artificial intelligence. And so those roles are shifting, but at the same time, there's big expansion in areas like cybersecurity. So if you're an accountant, say working for BHP or Rio or Fortescue, the question comes up, well, what do I do? You know, and similarly for the company, you know, do we lay off 100 accountants and employ 100 cybersecurity people? So clearly it's much better if those 100 accountants can become the 100 cybersecurity people, reskilling. And so what we do is we've built a platform that enables people to go in and do skills assessment. They can load their CV, they can put, I've done this course, I've done that course, I coached a soccer team, whatever, you know. And it does natural language processing. And it'll come back and say, look, here's a list of your skills. And then you can ask it, how do I compare to any number of jobs? You know, it could be, how do I compare to a team leader on a mine site? And it'll say, well, according to the skills in all the jobs that have been advertised, you've got these skills, but you've got these gaps. Then the program will run you into, here's some suggested training and development. So we do this for companies. We'll go in and they might say, look, we're interested in what are the latent skills of our workforce. We have records on them, but people are doing online courses with lifelong learning. And so we'd really like to know, are there people out there that we could be recruiting into data analytics or cybersecurity or, you know, any number of things, you know, digital marketing? So it's helping people understand what are the personal gaps. Where do I fit in this emerging world? But also helping companies do the same thing at a large level.
Wow, it's so fascinating. And hopefully resources and energy, that is such a ripe industry, what we're doing in our industry in terms of digitization, automation. It sounds like there's so much opportunity to do that. So I'm sure there's many companies already accessing the academy and hopefully more too as well. But I did mention that I wanted to touch on your academic and commercial, and you just touched on that you'd set up many centres and many companies. You're obviously an extremely accomplished academic, Bob, but would love to kind of understand the work that you've done in both of those commercial and academic spheres and how you balance the two to get outcomes, because a lot of your work is working with companies.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I always thought of myself as somewhat as an accidental academic. I'm probably not your typical academic. I love research. I love teaching also. So, but I also like the applications and working with industry. And I think, yeah, I mean, I trained as a psychologist. I could have been in a psych department doing more basic work, but I prefer to be in a business school and work with industry. So over the years, I've done a variety of things. I, for my sins, back when I was a young academic, I did a whole bunch of consulting work for the OECD and helped write some global rules around incentive payments for public sector executives. I worked with the Public Service Commission and developed the first set of competencies, the remuneration scheme for senior executives. So I've done a lot of that sort of work. With industry, I was an advisor to the Hong Kong government in the lead up to 1997 when they were decentralizing. So I've always gone into industry and worked things. In terms of products, I've done, you know, some have been successful and some haven't. I developed a product in collaboration with a colleague, Damien Burney at University of Sydney, which the ABC marketed called Active Memory. It was effectively a brain training program, you know, really training people in cognitive memory. It was great. We did a lot of research on it. It wasn't a great commercial success. It just hit the market at a time when lots of people releasing these products for free. Ours was, we believed, a superior product. It turned out the market didn't care. They prefer something cheap and free. So that was interesting. And then I started a company based on unconscious bias training and assessment. And that's done a lot of work with companies, Woodside and Rio, and you know, lots of different companies at different times. And then what else? Well, the centres I've done are all been applied and research centres. You know, so the Centre for Ethical Leadership I ran, that had a lot of participants from the mining and minerals. So we had people from Rio's head of major division. Over 10 years, I ran at Santos. Yeah, a variety of companies from the industry participated. So, yeah, so and I've always liked it. And so for me, it's always been moving between the two, working with industry. I currently sit on a few advisory boards for industry. I think that sort of keeps me fresh and focused. When I did my postdoc, the person I trained with, Al Bandura at Stanford, made the point that if psychology is not useful for people's lives, it shouldn't exist as a discipline. So I've always believed that whatever you do has to have some practical outcome. And so that's, and I think I'm a very practical person.
Yeah, sense. Absolutely. And you're on the AMA Aura, which is the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Advisory Board. It's such a fantastic dynamic board, and it's absolutely fantastic having you on it because you do provide that different perspective. I always see you taking in what everyone's doing and thinking of solutions and things that are already there that you can connect people to. But perhaps I'm going to touch back on unconscious bias because I have heard you in the industry being referenced as as the father of unconscious bias in Australia. Have you heard that? If so, how has that come to be?
They could be saying that.
Maybe. But is that because of the amount of work that you've done that's been...
Let's be clear, you know, unconscious bias, there's a global research process there. And then I got into studies of diversity and inclusion. And interestingly, I was interested in it not initially because of diversity and inclusion, but I study, you know, adaptivity. And so I'm always interested in adaptive challenges. That's where people have to think and do things differently. And diversity and inclusion, on the one hand, it seems so simple, but for some people... Yeah, some people who could be brilliant at maths or engineering or something, for somehow, you know, this idea of diversity was somehow the end of the world for them. It was like, you know, we're turning over, you know, not merit and all that. So I got very interested in it and pulled together an industry associate, a group, and we studied it for many years. And out of that came the unconscious bias research. We built a measurement tool and then we started running programs. That was very successful. And so I gave... I was giving like about 30 talks a year espousing diversity and inclusion, and unconscious bias was part of that. You know, it wasn't the only thing, but I did a talk on the role of unconscious bias in safety. And so I often used to use the analogy of what the mining industry and oil and gas and others had done around safety was analogous to what they were doing around diversity and inclusion. Yeah, and when you look at inclusive leadership, it looks a lot like good safety behavior, right? The other point that we made was, you know, these low-level events, and this came out of our research, like sexist jokes, ultimately roll up into more severe forms of aggression and harassment and the like. Just like in safety, you know, near misses become... you know, lost time injuries that become, you know, more serious injuries and ultimately may become fatalities. We discovered in our research that the same thing happens. You create a culture of tolerance around bias and discrimination and sexism. And people say, I'm just joking. But then it, you know, not, you know, for a very small percentage, it gets a little bit more, you know, gets into some more extreme behavior, harassment, and then, you know, misunderstandings develop in it. Topples over into something more extreme. So that was a point we made for many years. And we've done a lot of, you know, we spun it off as a commercial company, which I'm not, you know, I'm still a director of, but not heavily involved in now because I've moved on to other things. But yeah, which has done a lot of training in the mining and oil and gas industry.
I can understand you getting that name now, whether it's father or grandfather, but I do want to ask another unconscious bias question, because unconscious bias has been the work that you've done, and as you said, the global research that's been done on it has been really significant, and it's really shifted people's thinking from a workplace perspective. Yeah. But we now often see that it can become a little bit tokenistic. So companies can say, yes, we're, you know, supporting our leaders in their in our D&I journey because we've sent all our leaders on unconscious bias training.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Where do you think unconscious bias sits in what you could potentially describe to me is in a broader scope of what companies need to, you know, think about in terms of the big elements for diversity and inclusion?
Yeah, well, unconscious bias training is like any training. It doesn't work unless you work on the transfer. Yeah, so it's no, yeah, a lot of people go back to a culture and they remember the stories and they're interested, but if it's not supported by the broader culture and the systems and processes, it doesn't work. And that's not unique to that unconscious bias training. That's true of any training, right?
Absolutely.
So it does, what it does require, it requires, you know, policies and procedures. It requires overhaul of selection processes. People need to be very serious about it because, and it's not just about, oh, we're doing this for minorities, women or whoever, you know, is that discriminate. It really is about living up to the merit principle that people espouse. And people talk about diversity as being anti-merit. It's very pro-merit. It's saying, look, let's take the bias out of our systems. Let's actually select people for the true talent. And so there's a wide range, like with companies we've worked with, overhauling their selection processes. The order in which you do things is very important. There's lots and lots of simple steps that companies can take. And it's not limited, of course, to diversity and inclusion. We've been involved in capital investment decisions and how bias in those often leads to very poor decision processes. What you have, Tara, you have this dilemma. Unconscious decision making or intuitive or system one, whatever you want to call it, is very fast and it's efficient. It just, and so if it's good expertise in the right place, it's great. It's just that in the wrong place, it's not. Why do we do it? Well, because it reduces the burden on our mental processing. The moment we start trying to think consciously, the burden can be overwhelming. So it's no good just to simply say, I'm going to be conscious about every decision. What you need to do is to start designing processes that facilitate the processing in an automatic way. Yeah, just a really simple thing that we introduce. If you're in a selection process, at the very least, you should draw up a matrix that has the name of the candidates down one side and the criteria across the others, and then score them separately. Yeah, people often just make holistic judgments. It appalls me. I'm sitting on a selection committee and somebody says, oh, yeah, I know these types. Yeah, and it's like, whoa, you know, it's like they've just finessed all the details. So, but as I said, you need processes, simple tools that enable that. I'm also a big favor of quotas. Contrary to what people believe, they do not lead to it's like anything. If you set people a challenging goal, first of all, they work harder at what they've done in the past. And if that doesn't work, then at one point they reach a fork in the road. And some people say, this doesn't work, we have to do something different. Others will say, oh, it's ridiculous, it doesn't work, and they'll quit. And that same is true about quotas for women. You know, basically, you need to do things differently. You know, when I was DVC at U of WA, one of the things I required was for all the deans or whoever they delegate the task to go out and discover who are all the female academics, particularly Australians overseas, who are coming up to promotion professor, who might be interested in coming back. Yeah, so you actively search. You don't just rely on your intuitive memory, which takes you to more males. There's lots of strategies. Another simple one is think about your go-to person. And so we would regularly say, look, a major function of a leader is developing the capabilities of your team. But if you're constantly going to the same go-to person, you're not developing the others. And so in the mining industry, we would do this all the time. We'd say, who are your go-to people? You know, 95% of the time, if it was a male supervisor, it would be a male. We'd say, well, diversify it out, you know, take the risk, you know, get, you know, help them develop. You know, so the answer is you really need to supplement the unconscious bias training with lots of other processes and simple behaviors. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And I do want to get on to your study and the work that you're doing on adaptivity. I wanted that first, though, go and talk about the evolution of work and the evolutions of the workplace and work, you know, forces over time. How have you seen, even just in the last two decades, how have you seen workforces and workplaces changing? Have they changed at all? You know, we talk about the future of work all the time, but would love your perception.
Yeah. So let me use an analogy. Yeah, when I played, well, AFL, but in the Waffle in Western Australia, right, you were assigned a position. And if you wandered too far from your position, you got told off. Yeah, you get down there, right?
Pull now right back.
Yeah, nowadays, anybody who watch AFL, and sorry to use the analogy for people who are not interested, but it's just free-flowing, right? So it's much more dynamic. So I think workplaces have become much more dynamic over time. You know, so people have roles. There's much more fluidity. I think the first big change I saw was, you know, the single career. Like when I went to BHP, when I left BHP to go off and study, you know, I was being told, oh, you're giving up on a good job, a good career. You know, so many people had worked with BHP and, like me, started out as either a cadet or a trainee or something, you know, a graduate. And they were there. They were now the general managers, Brian Lowton, I think at the time, was the CEO. He'd started as a graduate. Yeah, so that was very common and positions were very circumscribed. Then over time that changed. It became much more dynamic. People started to move. You know, I know in the mining industry now people talk about boomerangs. You know, people who leave and come. Yeah, we want them to come back. Some are spears. When you throw them, you want them to keep going and not come back. I've heard that analogy. I think the first big change was the fixedness of work. Like I grew up in Kalgoorlie. It was a mining town. Then at some stage, well, you don't need to build a town. You can be a fly-in, fly-out. And so there was just this much more flexibility and like, I think that was a big change, right? And also the idea that people started managing their own careers. I think companies moved away from this, you know, highly orchestrated, managed career. I think they do it to some degree with graduates. I then think, and of course, all the time there is changing. So in the mining industry, something that has changed radically is how much mining and exploration is not on site. The growth in jobs and technology and sophisticated. And it took a long time for the industry, and it's really just adjusting now to saying, you don't have to have spent 6 months in the back of, you know, out of Mongolia on a drilling rig in order to be head of engineering in this company. So that has changed. Now, that wasn't done explicitly for women, but of course it opened up the ideas. And so I think in mining, the whole move into automation, you know, driving down the cost curve and the like. And so, and then of course, the most recent one, the, you know, people were talking about digital transformation, literally nothing was happening. And then COVID hit. And that massive change, I mean, the fluidity of work and the idea, and this is what the Futures Academy is about, anytime, anywhere, any device. And I think that's starting to impact now. So what I'm seeing is this increasing fluidity. We've moved away from this highly fixed, this is your job, this is your career, this is your company until you retire. And now, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I was born in the 50s. I grew up mainly in the 60s and 70s. And so all of that has changed quite radically. Yeah, keep in mind, it wasn't until the early 80s that a woman who got married had to leave the public service. I mean, it's amazing to think of, right?
And I think 82 was the first woman underground.
Yeah. So the whole diversification, that process has been very slow. But I think now we're starting to see, you know, the barriers and realize what we think of as men's jobs and women's jobs is breaking down. But also what we think of as jobs is changing, right, with skills, you know, geochemicals and a lot of, you know, biochemistry. These are terms that didn't exist when I was a kid. Yeah, we had chemistry and we had biology. Now we've got biochemistry. And that comes from technology like microscopy, use of microscopes. You know, it's electron microscopes are used in, by the same ones are used by mechanical engineers studying materials as biologists and doctors. And they study, you know, the flow of material in not dissimilar ways. So there's this constant evolution. And because mining and oil and gas are in that STEM engineering, they're right at the front of it. You know, it's just changing all the time. Yeah.
Well, you've just preempted my next question, and thank you so much for answering that question in the context of resources and energy, because you work across so many industries. Yeah. And I want to ask you this question, particularly with that, you know, helicopter view that you have across a number of industries. You just touched on STEM disciplines. You just touched on the fact that we're at the forefront of technological change and implementing it and delivering on that change. How do you think resource and energy is going in terms of the pace of change in terms of work, and how do you think it's going preparing its workforces for this ongoing change that technology is delivering?
I would have said slowly, but it has really ramped up. You know,
okay.
Most of the investment has really been around large-scale automation, you know, driverless trains and driverless trucks and all that, and they were big first steps. But the digital transformation of the industry is ongoing, I think. My big fear right now is we're moving into this whole digital data analytics that's all expanding, and we don't have the supply of women. The growth in STEM in schools, while it has increased, and Aura and Emma have been really influential in all the work and all the work you're doing now. I wish, you know, this...
We'd done it 10 years ago.
10 years ago, yeah. And so, you know, my daughter Daisy, you know, is a data analyst, and she's just, you know, started work. And so there are lots of jobs in that area right now. And so I'm hoping that people start reskilling. I think, you know, shout out to Fortescue. I think the work that Linda O'Farrell and the team are doing there around traineeships, bringing women and Indigenous people in, training in apprenticeships, which then hopefully a certain percentage of those will go on, maybe complete an engineering degree and become, you know, senior engineers. But we need to be getting more, you know, not just women, but Indigenous people, you know, other minorities in at the lower levels as soon as possible. Because right now there's lots of opportunities and...
Can't see the pipeline.
And the government, as always with the, you know, Australian governments, you know, they're investing very heavily and that's great. But the need is now. I mean, the idea that we might have invested 10 years ago I don't know if you remember, Malcolm Turnbull had the Innovation Nation, but it was a slogan. It had nothing else, right? You go back another 82, 83, Barry Jones had the Education Nation slogan. Never got anywhere. You know, if somebody at that stage had set a goal to say, you know, 40% of our graduates are going to be STEM-based and 50% are going to be women and 50% are going to be men, we may not have got there, but if people accepted the goal and did something about it, we would have been much further along than we are now. Our governments are just very reluctant at setting specific challenging goals the way, you know, like Kennedy said, we're going to put a person on the moon by the end of the decade. And 8 years later, they did. Now, none of the technology, when he said that in
late 60s, yeah.
Yeah. When he said that, the technology didn't exist to do it. They didn't have the strategies, right? They knew they wanted to do it. And so they said part of getting there, and I think the first one was, it was done across three stages. I can't remember the detail, but Apollo was one. And so they were working out, okay, first of all, how do we get something into space and stable? How do we create it? You know, so they accepted the challenge and they broke it down. Our governments need to be more like that.
You know, the budget came down recently, you know, probably a couple of weeks ago when people are listening to this recording of our podcast. And of course, I've been through it with a fine tooth comb in terms of STEM and diversity. And while there is quite a bit of money, it's spread over quite a bit of time. Yeah. And so, and you know, and there are 5,000 places for females apprenticeships. That's over a number of years. Yeah. And that's not just for resource and energy. That's probably at a minimum what we would need as an industry, sure. Let alone sharing that with construction and other industries. And so the scale is just not where we need it to be. And so it's upon us as industry to work with the government of the day, but then really drive the outcomes that we need. But, you know, you've just touched on the space race and challenges and vision. So I want to ask you back to more of a future of work question. What do you think that the human resources, industrial relations, you know, the people within an organization, what do you think are the things that they should be thinking about?
I think human adaptivity is the key thing, right? Because, okay, so right now everybody's preoccupied with the technical skills, right? And so data analytics and the like. So I've got two of my four children are in that space, data analytics. And both of them front the idea that in 10 years, if they're lucky, their job won't exist. So, and I use the example, right, when I was a graduate, if I wanted to do a statistical analysis, I had to write programs using Fortran and TROF and all this. And then along came SPSS. So people, then anybody could do it, right? And that's what's going to happen with data analytics, right? Data analytics right now, Daisy and Jack and, you know, lots of people like them are working on models and developing it. But eventually it's going to be programmed and assembled. And so you or I will sit at our desk and
we'll be able to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And so then the question is, well, what do they do next? What are my kids and all the other day? Well, you know, they fall back on their social skills. They take what they know and they learn something else. Yeah. So, you know, you've heard of the T-shaped person, right? And the World Economic Forum says, yeah, the number one skills are not data analytics and cybersecurity. They're important. They're important right now, just like environmental science and accounting were important and remain important in many places, right? But it's this idea of change and how can you adapt to change? And so it's human adaptability, it's problem solving, social skills. And it's sort of interesting, just to take my daughter as an example. She's, you know, she's good at data analytics, but she says, look, I'm not top of my class. But she's got good social skills. Why? When she was at uni, she went and worked in retail in Sports Girl. And so she learned, we spent a lot of time talking, she learned to deal with difficult people. And she learned to have conversations and manage the whole process and keep people on side and stuff. Yeah. And her point, when she went and interviewed, they were the big, everybody was qualified in data analytics, had a master's. But, you know, she's, you know, her point was, I can deal with people, and she could give examples, and I learn, I extract value from my experience as I go. You know, and that's what people are hiring for. And they're perennial skills. I think most HR managers would say, yeah, yeah, we know that and we do that. But it's sort of interesting when you think about this T-shaped person, and for your listeners, basically the idea is the top of the T, that's the horizontal piece, is about your general skills. You know, you take them everywhere, your social skills, your problem-solving skills, your empathy and those things. The vertical of the T is your technical skills. Now, interestingly, most of our identity and social connection is tied up with our technical skills. And so that means when my accounting role is no longer valid, you know, my sense of identity is challenged. So it takes, it's not just how difficult is it to learn a new skill, but how do I reformulate my identity to my children, to my friends, the people I hang out with? And then what's the social dislocation? And so there's these, I think of personal change as having these three dimensions. How difficult is this, the reskilling? The second one is, what does this mean for my identity, who I am? And the third one is, what's the social displacement? Decades ago, when I was advising the Hong Kong government through corporatization in the lead up to 1997, I had many senior engineers saying, so Bob, what do you mean I'm a leader? And I'd say, well, he said, no, I'm an engineer.
Yeah, right.
You mean I have to go home and tell my children I'm a leader or a manager? You're kidding. My child is doing engineering at Hong Kong University because he wants to be like, yeah, it was that. So the identity is a really important part of it. Yeah.
Well, you touched on how, you know, HR and workforce people think about it. You know, you touched on a couple of things like the recruitment process of what they hire for. But let's talk practically for a sec. And you might be able to use some examples of work you're doing in your institute at the moment with companies. How can companies practically assist their workforces, not new ones they're looking for, but their existing workforces who are dealing with this change from an identity perspective and from a technical perspective? What can they do generally to support them?
I think the first thing, if you're, let's say we do quite a bit of work with the banking industry, for example. Mm-hmm. Not untypical. A person's worked for the bank for 25 years. They don't have a CV. They completed university, have been there for 25 years. And by the way, your job is not going to exist in 3 months. And so that is a major challenge, right? So look, can I just say, before I go on, the members of the Aura board, you know, Jackie from Woodside and Linda and all those, they're outstanding at this. I actually think your industry is probably more advanced than most in this, in helping people. It doesn't mean it's perfect. And the nice thing about them, it's very dynamic. It's highly individualistic, right? Because some people just get angry. Some are keen to learn, but
scared.
But,
yeah.
So there tends to be a lot of coaching going on, which is not easy. If you're a 45-year-old, you've been working at this, for 25 years, you've got good performance reviews, you've had salary increases, and suddenly, look, we're wiping out your role. And then you're thinking, well, what do I do? It's a major disruption. I don't have an easy answer. I mean, coaching is a very important part of it. Mm-hmm. I think too many companies have jumped to the generous redundancy package. But you think about that. We're going to have a lot of 45-year-olds, kids still in school, scrambling around for re-employment. And I think now the banking industry is starting to say, well, what about cybersecurity? How can we move people?
The adaptive component you talked about.
That often does require people to become more adaptive. And that's not as complex as it sounds. Adaptivity is not a fixed trait. It's very learnable. And I know from talking to you, your children get the growth mindset at school, right?
That's absolutely.
That's an example of one aspect of adaptivity. It's just one aspect, but important one,
Well, can you tell us a couple of the other aspects then?
So we've broken it down into four sets of capabilities, right? The first one is mindsets. The second one is motivation. The third one, interesting, is thinking. And then the final one is teaming, being able to work with other people and like have the social skills, go off and get a job. I was talking to some students at Melbourne University the other day and about work, and they were saying how, I have an arts degree, how can I be competitive? I said, well, get a job in retail and learn, and so.
I tell everyone to coach a sporting team and be a captain of a sporting team while they're doing all those
things. Yeah, those life experiences are increasingly important, right? So let's, on the mindsets, it's quite clearly growth mindset. So when you're thinking about what you can do, don't focus on I lack ability. Think about what are my strategies? How do I make this work? And if I try hard, right? Another very important one that comes out of my own research is game frame. Thinking about, always focus on your progress. You've heard me use this example. If somebody's asking you, aren't you finished yet? It's sort of focusing on what you haven't done, and it leads to a rejection. Whereas, if you focus on, well, what have you achieved? And a game frame is used widely in the minerals and resources industry with safety observations. So if I come up to you and say, Tara, where's your helmet? That's a loss frame, you know, what you haven't got done. But if I come up and say, look, Tara, you've got your boots on, you've got your PP and your glasses, where's your helmet? It's a game frame. It focuses on all the – and the response, all it does is validate common sense. So the game frame leads to a much more positive engagement. And, of course, when you're working on challenges, there's going to be failures and setbacks. And so this combination of a growth mindset where you focus on strategies and what can I do rather than why I lack ability, and secondly, how much have I achieved and can I build on that? Another very important mindset is curiosity. Just simply being curious, learning to ask questions. And I think I've told you, this research is really interesting. You know, people often think about, oh, he or she's curious or he or she's not curious, as though it's a trait. But what we've discovered is most people are curious about something. Now, it could be rock and roll music of the 70s, or it could be anything, right? It could be chess, it could be. But one of the interesting things, what we've discovered is some people are very curious in a technical sense, but not in a social sense. And guess what? We're working with a large bank, the Reserve Bank, actually, and they need their technical people to lead the change for digital transformation. They were quite strong on technical curiosity, but very weak on social curiosity. And our point is, you have to be socially curious, because socially curious underpins empathy, you know, because empathy is about understanding the other person. And empathy is really important to leadership. And so those leadership and empathy are part of the teaming skills. So if you don't have a socially curious mindset, you're not going to get there.
Well, talking about particularly those four things, but I want to ask you about those four sets in another practical area that we know here at AMA that our members are really grappling with at the moment, not the vaccine, although that's a whole other area that the industry is grappling with, but workplace flexibility. Yeah. So, you know, we've touched on COVID and the immense change, and we've absolutely moved away from insisting that everybody has to be at a particular place, whether that's site or whether that's in the office or somewhere else. But what are your thoughts on this evolution and this change, and where do you think it will land us in terms of what companies should be doing in terms of approach to flexible work?
Well, I think technology is facilitating that, the anytime, anywhere, any device. I think if you said to me, and back to the students, I said, you know, when you go out to work, the expectation may be that you work flexibly. And they said, now, one of the big problems with flexible work is it requires much more self-discipline than if you go into work. And
so the motivation element.
Motivation becomes very important, as does the thinking component. So you need some structuring processes. Yeah, you know, because if you go into work, you know, there's meetings, there's expectations, and in between, you know, you know what you're doing, your supervisor or your colleague.
There's eyeballs.
Yeah, totally. So I said, well, how many of you know about Trello, for example, which is a task management system? And most of them didn't. I said, well, you know, that's becoming increasingly important. So knowing these systems that are online for task management, it's a necessary skill. It's like writing or being able to operate a computer. And so it's what provides structure and facilitates, you know, effectiveness in that world. And so I remember decades ago, I gave a talk and I was saying then about computer skills. And I was saying they're a bit like if you were an administrator in India in the 1850s, you had to know how to ride a horse because it didn't matter how good an accountant you were. If you couldn't ride a horse, you couldn't get the job done. And so it's a little bit like that. Yeah, what are the skills that we need, the Trello or whatever, and being comfortable and efficient at using those.
Do you think companies will very much, you know, want border restrictions and different sorts of practices of having, do you think the majority of organisations will slide straight back into previous operating?
No, I don't. Look, I personally prefer face-to-face meetings because I think they're more efficient, more dynamic, and essential. No, I don't think they will. And I think the reason's mainly economic, because the cost savings around asset utilization are so high. So, you know, I've noticed universities are reluctant to open up buildings.
It was in the media today. And why have we only got students with one or two contact hours a week? And we want people to go into workforces where they have to engage with people.
And the answer is, yeah, we've taken a big hit on fees, so we're trying to slice costs, and putting buildings into sleep mode is a big saving right now. Let's be clear, once you've learned how to save money, the temptation is to continue that, right? Because university is going to take some time to find new revenue sources. Several companies I've heard, Goldman Sachs or some, have come out and said they're going to cut their in-time office space by at least 25%. And so that means one quarter of our rented offices in New York or wherever they hire, you know, very expensive space is going to go. But in many ways, that anytime, anywhere. Years ago, I wrote a paper about looking at flexible work. And one of the examples we looked at, British Telecom for years has been developing systems that facilitate it. And one part of their marketing was reduce your carbon footprint, your asset base, you know, your real estate base, et cetera. So I think for those reasons, Tara, it won't go back to where it was previously.
We're hearing very generally that people are reluctant as well. People are wanting and demanding from their employers that through COVID, we've proven that we can, particularly our industries, kept the lights on and moving while other industries have shut down. Mm-hmm. And they've proven that we can do it. And so a lot of people are talking to us about this big reluctance that they're seeing from their workforces.
Yeah, and of course, COVID went on long enough for people to develop new habits and to reorganize themselves. And so that's the challenge, right, for the people. And my guess is most companies will listen to their employees and work around it. You know, even before this, I mean, I remember one organization we're looking at, and I just asked them to pull out the data on flex days. And of course, 90% of them were Friday and Monday. And it's so obvious in retrospect, but they hadn't done it because they were having a lot of problems where people had agreed arrangements around flex days and other people were getting upset because they couldn't get them. And the reason was everybody wants Friday and Monday. So if you've already locked in two people, that means
the rest miss out.
Mm. Yeah. And the point then became you have to be flexible about your flex days. But then that raises issues around childcare and fixed arrangements, which some organizations are solving, some mining companies are solving by having creches.
Yeah, that's right. Innovation, driven by those needs.
Small innovations like that make a world. Childcare, for women's involvement, flexibility is really a compensating mechanism for a lot of the childcare stuff, but it still makes it very difficult if you're having to look after kids and try to work. I've done that with my grandkids, and it's not an easy ask, I can assure you.
It's not an easy ask having the broad range of topics that we touched on. But as usual, Bob, it's been absolutely wonderful hearing your thoughts on such a broad range of topics. Thank you so much for giving us your time to come on Resource People Podcast.
Thanks a lot, Tara. It's always great to talk to you and work with you.
I hope you found this episode with Professor Bob Wood interesting. Vision, inspiration, but also practically. So I hope you got a lot out of it. And we look forward to having you join us on Resource People Podcast again soon.
AMA acknowledges and pays respects to the traditional custodians of the land from which the Resource People Podcast was recorded from today, both the Turrbal and Yugara people. AMA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which you are living, learning and listening to this podcast from today. We pay our respects to elders both past, present and emerging.
Thank you for listening to the Resource People Podcast. We look forward to you joining us next time as we highlight the many great stories of the resources and energy industry. If you have any questions about the podcast, please email media@ama.org.au. Produced by Brad Thompson.